Well, thanks again for coming. This really is an exciting time in the area of eyewitness identifications and eyewitness memory. Today, I'm going to talk about a lineup. You'll see the lineup in a minute when that warms up. But I should tell you, while we're waiting for our lineup to show up, this is not the lineup in the Troy Davis case. It's another Georgia lineup in another case. And in fact, I'm not going to talk too much about the Troy Davis case for some reasons that I'll describe, including that we don't know enough about what happened at the lineups in his case. So I'm going to talk to you about some other case. But the some other case that I'm talking about is a really fascinating one where we do know a fair amount more about what happened. And it's a good illustration of how eyewitness memory works, what some of the problems are with it. I mentioned that it's an exciting time. The Supreme Court just heard arguments yesterday in the first case involving questions surrounding procedures, due process, and eyewitness identifications yesterday in a case called Perry versus New Hampshire. I'm not sure that that case is actually a reason to be particularly excited. The case involved some fairly technical state action issues and probably won't touch the larger questions that we're going to talk about today. Things are more exciting because of developments in the states, and I'll talk a little bit more later about a decision in a case called Henderson in New Jersey just a few weeks ago. But I think because the Henderson decision came down at the same time that the Supreme Court was taking its first case in 34 years, and right around the same time that people were asking what went wrong in the eyewitness identifications in the Troy Davis case, or did they go wrong, or should we be executing this person, and it was the same time that a real landmark nationwide four-state field study occurred, testing some of the social science on eyewitness memory. All that was sort of all happening just in the last couple weeks. So there's been a lot going on, and hopefully after looking at this one lineup, you'll understand everything about what's going on. So here's our lineup. This lineup occurred in Georgia, in Manchester County, Georgia. I've never been there. Have any of you familiar with Manchester County, Georgia? Well, a small police department there. And in Manchester County, Georgia, an elderly woman was sexually assaulted in her home. The police later conducted this lineup. She described her perpetrator. And the man she picked was a man named John Jerome White. Now, why do we care about this case? Well, I've written this book called Convicting the Innocent. The John Jerome White case is one of the cases I wrote about. It's a case where years later, DNA testing exonerated the defendant. So we now know John Jerome White was innocent and that this identification was an error. Now, my project when I wrote this book was to go back and look at all these exonerations, 250 of them spread all around the country, to try to get a sense of what went wrong. Now, just because a state has a deeper orange or red color doesn't mean that there's something especially wrong with the state's criminal justice system. Some states, for example, don't have many DNA exonerations because they simply didn't preserve biological evidence from crime scenes. Some states may have more exonerations because they had unusually active innocence projects early on. Most of these cases, like the John Jerome White case, which we'll turn back to in a second, involved a rape precisely because those are the cases where you can do DNA testing that can tell you a lot about who the perpetrator of the crime is. There are some murder cases, most of the murders also involved a sexual assault. And then there are a few other murder cases where maybe the assailant left a mask at this crime scene and everyone knew that that mask was associated with the robber. But for the most part, you know, these cases are unusual cases. They're cases where there was a very serious sexual assault, serious enough that someone spent so long in prison that the technology had fundamentally changed by the time that DNA testing came around. They were still in prison, and they pursued an exoneration. In a lot of these cases, that same DNA testing identified the actual perpetrator of the crime. Now, what I had to do to write this book was to try to track down all of the original criminal trials of these people. People typically haven't done trial studies of what happens in actual criminal trials because these materials are really hard to come by. Mostly the studies that have been done involve surveys of judges and jurors to try to get a sense of You know, did judges agree with what the jurors found, and if so, why? What did jurors think was important? But typically, those haven't been matched up with, well, if the jurors thought it was important, well, what did that witness actually say at trial? What was the trial evidence? The problem has been that court reporters typically are the ones who transcribe criminal trials. There may only be one copy of the transcript prepared. It's often with a lot of help from a lot of lawyers around the country and clerk's office, courthouse libraries, and a lot of really frustrating and annoying work making just lots of phone calls, I was able to track down a lot of trial transcripts in these unusual cases where DNA later freed someone. And so then I had to read all of the trials. And some wonderful UVA law students over the years helped me do that, particularly just identifying, you know, what page does the eyewitness testify? At what page does the detective start explaining how they did the lineup? It was just helpful to have lots of eyes mapping everything out, making sure that we didn't miss anything in these trials. But I also had to read it all myself. If anyone is interested, there's lots of data and sort of back-end stuff on these websites that you can get to from my faculty page. A lot that just couldn't fit in the book. The publisher was sort of happy for me to include, you know, 10 or 12 pages in an appendix, but not, you know, hundreds of pages with details about what happened in every single one of these cases. So that's all online. Okay, back to our lineup. I'd like to conduct a identification procedure here. So what the victim said when she described to the police who attacked her, she said it was an African-American man in his 20s or 30s. Not that helpful. Then she said it was a man who was well-built and had a round face. So now you be the eyewitness and look at our lineup here. So who's the one with the round face and who's well-built? Any thoughts on who should be selected as the culprit in this case? The guy in the far right, he really stands out as he's the only one. Everyone else is unusually skinny, right? There's just, you know, no extra pounds on person 1, 2, 3, and 4. And person number 5 is the only plausibly well-built, round-faced person in the entire lineup. Now, would a judge say, well, this lineup is clearly suggestive, that person stands out, it should be suppressed? Probably not. Judges look at a whole range of factors. We'll talk about the test that they apply. And, you know, they did try to arrange these people in descending order in terms of height so that no one's height would stand out. They're not wearing similar clothing, but none of them were wearing clothing that was, you know, the same as what the culprit was wearing at the time or anything like that. They all have some facial hair. Their haircuts aren't totally different, although they're not similar either. Maybe not the best lineup, certainly I think we'd all pick number 5 as the well-built guy. Here's the test that the Supreme Court adopted in 1977. This is that case 34 years ago, which probably isn't going to be revisited by the current case. And so they ask, first, was the procedure unnecessarily suggestive? But even if a court concluded, wait a minute, that guy stands out, he's the only one who's well-built with a round face, our court could still say, look, the identification was nevertheless reliable, we'll still let it in. And so they'll look at a number of factors. They'll look at the opportunity of the eyewitness to view the person, the degree of attention at the time that the crime happened, the accuracy of the prior description, the eyewitness's level of certainty, and the length of time between the crime and the identification. Now, this identification, this lineup that we saw, occurred over a month after the crime, so some time had passed. Really, studies show that eyewitnesses' memory fades extremely rapidly, actually, in hours after an incident. And so if length of time after the incident really mattered a lot to judges, they would be doing a lot of excluding, since, again, it's, you know, hours and minutes after seeing someone, a stranger, one's memory rapidly degrades. That factor, therefore, doesn't receive much emphasis in the case law. And similarly, you know, this was an incident that occurred at night. It was dark. The victim wasn't wearing her glasses, but it was an incident that occurred. It wasn't like a brief glimpse you get, you know, if someone runs into a store, holds it up, and then runs out. it was a prolonged and quite, you know, traumatic assault. So the eyewitness could say, look, I had plenty of time to observe this person. Even though it was dark, I got a good look close up, unfortunately. And then the description matching, level of certainty, all of that seemed to suggest that, you know, maybe this is reliable, or certainly reliable enough. You very, very rarely see a court exclude an eyewitness identification applying this test. They sort of look at the totality of the circumstances, particularly if the eyewitness seems confident. Doesn't matter if they had been drunk at the time, if they had, you know, the worst vision in the world, if they saw the person from 300 yards away. You see wild cases with extreme facts where judges still say, well, I think it's nevertheless reliable, I'll let it in. And this case doesn't raise any of those extreme facts. Now, back to our lineup, you know, the jury wouldn't have focused on this. Right, this was an exhibit at trial, but what the jury saw was much more personal and dramatic. Right, they saw that moment that you've seen on TV, right, where the eyewitness identifies the person and points them out in the courtroom. Obviously, it's easy to see where the defendant is sitting in the courtroom, right, at a counsel's table next to their lawyer. But nevertheless, although the person may be easy to find in the courtroom, right, in a case like this where it's a victim who's the eyewitness, right, they've just described everything that's happened. They've described how they came to identify the defendant in lineups. They've described this horrible ordeal. And typically, like in this case, at the end of the direct, the prosecutor asks the eyewitness, do you see this person in the courtroom? And here's a short excerpt from the trial testimony. They asked her to even come out of the witness stand and walk up to him to point him out. So a really dramatic display, very powerful to a jury. And of course, we now know that this eyewitness was wrong. With the benefit of DNA testing, right? This is one of those unusual cases where we know for sure that something went wrong. John Jerome White ended up spending 22 years in prison based really on this, based on this identification. Some of those years were spent based on interaction with another offense that he was convicted of. So what happened here? How did this go wrong? Well, here's some other examples of eyewitnesses who are absolutely certain, even though they were wrong. Some quotes that I include in my book. This is the man or it's his twin brother. That is one face I'll never forget. 100% sure, my favorite. 120% sure. And so across these trials, there's nothing special about this case. Without exception, almost, there are one or two exceptions. These eyewitnesses were absolutely sure at the time of trial that they had picked out the right person. And so that, you know, how did that false confidence come about? What went wrong? Well, the social science research has long looked at these questions because after all, lineups are experiments. And what they suggest is that, and there have been almost 2,000 experiments now done, most of which, except just one or two really, were done after the Supreme Court's decision in Manson. That was right when some of the leading researchers had just started to replicate lineups in the laboratory. What they've suggested is that when you first see a stranger, right, you form some memory in your mind about that face, and we're particularly good at remembering faces, not so great at remembering height or clothes or other things. Then there's the process of retaining that memory. But every time you're asked to retrieve that memory can be altered. And so a lineup is not just a passive test where you have a photo in your mind, like that eyewitness said, but in fact you have to sort of reconstruct the image in your mind every time you're asked to remember that stranger's face. And the process used to test the memory and reconstruct that image can actually change it. And so they talk about system variables, which are the things that police can affect, the procedures that they use to test someone's memory. And those can dramatically affect not only who you remember, but also how confident you are. And second, there are estimator variables, things that police can't control. Things like the lighting. Witnesses have a great deal of difficulty recognizing people of another race, also of another age. Things like the time that passes, stress, focusing on a weapon. There are a lot of other things that can also impact the memory of an eyewitness. And of course, we all know this from our everyday lives. We run into people and think that it's someone we know, we're about to say hi to them, and then we realize it's a stranger. Right? It happens all the time that we forget what people look like who we just met. But we assume that when someone is called on to identify a stranger in a criminal case, that police would take extra precautions. Well, what went wrong here? Let's go back to our lineup. Okay, here's our lineup. So there was a glaring problem with this case. I haven't told you who John Jerome White was. John Jerome White was the guy in the middle. Right? He was not the guy with the round face who was well built. So how did that guy get picked out? And to unpack that really sheds light on the problem, on how lineup procedures can cause errors. You know, he doesn't look too worried to be there, and we now know he was innocent, right? He probably thought this was some kind of a joke. He's like, you know, the most nonchalant of all of them, right? So how did he get identified? Well, it turns out this was not the first identification procedure the police conducted. It was the second. And reading the trial transcripts, I found that this eyewitness had actually earlier looked at a photo array. And police showed her a photo array even closer to the time of the crime and asked, do you recognize any of these people? And John Jerome White's picture was in that initial photo array. She actually said at that time that she was absolutely unsure. She was uncertain. You know, she focused on John Jerome White's picture but couldn't identify him. So it was a non-identification, and she told the police, I'm really not sure. And so what did the officers do? I have no doubt that they were acting with the best of intentions. They wanted to do another test because the victim wasn't sure. And so they said, okay, you know, we'll conduct another procedure. So they then conduct this live lineup. But John Jerome White was the only person repeated from the photo array to the live lineup. And they did something else. They told the eyewitness, and you have to understand, right, police know that plenty of victims, especially in sexual assaults, right, decide not to go forward with the case. They don't want to have to revisit these events. Maybe in an effort to reassure her, encourage her to come into the station, despite the fact that, look, this time you're going to have to come in and see your attacker face to face, they say, we caught somebody, implying that this time we've arrested him, we have him in person. And so what she may have done is looked straight ahead, and there's John Jerome White, the guy that she had identified before, and that's the one the police caught, right? The police said, you know, this time we caught someone. And so she just may have not focused on anyone else. She sees the same person. These aren't like experiments where you can control for everything. We don't know what particular thing caused these eyewitnesses to have this false confidence. Certainly, though, we know from research that comments like that, like we caught somebody, or other innocuous comments like good job, you picked out the guy you picked before, can predictably increase the confidence of eyewitnesses even when they're wrong. And what this also shows is that it doesn't take intentional police misconduct, intentional suggestion, to cause a wrongful identification. Right, we've heard of cases that were like in The Wire, you know, someone taps on the photo array and says, you know, take another look at number four. And in a few of these cases, there were instances like that where they show a single picture, let me just refresh your memory before you look at the lineup. Or, by the way, this person has a horrible record, multiple sexual assaults, you know, good job, you're going to take this horrible person off the streets. It was pretty unusual for anything like that to come out at trial. Of course, it doesn't mean that didn't happen. You know, it may just be that eyewitnesses don't remember it or don't want to talk about it at trial. But actually, what I was surprised at was how open these eyewitnesses were, and most of them were victims of these crimes, how open they were to describing how there were prior lineups. I wasn't that certain before. I'm certain now. I do remember how the defendant was the only one who really matched the description or someone who stood out, or I do remember how police told me that they arrested someone or caught someone. These eyewitnesses are actually pretty open about describing procedures that were suggestive and describing how their confidence changed over time. But what the jurors saw someone who is really confident now in the courtroom, and that's what impresses jurors. And so there's a fair amount of research on that, jury studies. First, just lay people aren't familiar with with how powerfully seemingly minor aspects of these police identification procedures, how powerfully they can affect someone's memory. And you wouldn't expect lay people to think that, right? I think lay people can certainly understand, and research suggests, we all know that it's hard to see someone from far away. We all know that it's hard to remember strangers generally, particularly if it's dark. But the idea that, you know, the words that police use when they show someone a lineup could affect someone's memory, right? That's not particularly intuitive, and we're not familiar with that. None of us, you know, have looked at lineups often, at least, maybe once in a while. So again, jurors also think that people who are confident should be trusted and are more reliable. But in fact, confidence is the most malleable feature of eyewitness memory. So judges are still, you know, have the same misunderstandings. It's easy to find opinions. Here are a couple examples from Virginia. Or judges say, look, the jury is perfectly capable of hearing the testimony and deciding for themselves whether it's reliable or not. And we heard some of that in the Supreme Court arguments just yesterday, where Justice Scalia, for example, said, tell it to the jury. Right? If there's a problem with the reliability of the evidence, explain it to the jury. Why can't the jury just understand this for themselves? And of course, the problem is what the jury sees is this incredibly confident witness who is sure. And unlike other forms of evidence, where if there's a problem with it, it can be explained to the jury, right? If a witness changes their story, you can impeach them with their prior testimony. If physical evidence is tampered with, right, you could bring that out. You can have an expert look at it. But how do you explain to the jury that someone's memory has changed, right? And that what this person remembers now isn't what they remembered before? You know, Jennifer Thompson, in the well-known Ronald Cotton case in North Carolina, has described how, you know, she now has an image of the wrong person in her head, and she knows that Cotton is innocent, but they know in that case who the real perpetrator was, and she doesn't recognize the real perpetrator. The wrong image is in her head, and she knows it. But how do you explain that to a jury? You can do it, and that's something that New Jersey is doing now after this Henderson decision. But it takes something very different, and it's not the kind of thing where you just sort of let the defense lawyer say something about it to the jury. So in the cases I looked at, there were just a lot of eyewitnesses across these innocent people's trials, in part because so many of these cases involve sexual assaults. A lot of the eyewitnesses were victims. This is surprising, right? A lot of the cases I looked at had multiple eyewitnesses, you know, more than a third. And so, you know, you'd expect a prosecutor to say, and you might tend to agree, right, maybe one eyewitness can get it wrong, but two eyewitnesses, three, four? Once you understand the role that bad lineup procedures and suggestion can play, if five eyewitnesses are shown the same lineup, or the defendant's photo is the only color photo, or where the police are telling everyone, good job, you picked out the guy, you can imagine everyone making the same mistake because there's the same problem with the lineup procedures. They have the same problem in common. And that's what happened, and apparently, in a lot of these cases, including well-known cases like the Kirk Bloodsworth case in Maryland. There were five eyewitnesses there. He was the first person freed from death row by post-conviction DNA testing. So almost half of these cases involved cross-racial identifications. The victim in the John Jerome White case was white, as were many of the other victims. And again, that jibes precisely with the research that suggests how much more difficulty people have recognizing people of another race. That's not something police can control. It's something judges can do something about, though, by giving instructions to the witnesses on this. And in fact, the New Jersey Supreme Court first became aware of the problems with eyewitness identifications, at least more recently, in a case about 10 years ago, the case of McKinley Cromedy. And they reversed his conviction on appeal, saying, no, this jury should have been told about research on cross-racial identifications. There's powerful research. It could have been an important factor in this case. It was error not to allow the jury to hear about that. After the appeal was granted, they did DNA testing and found out he was innocent. So that must have really, you know, brought it home that, wait a minute, they recognized a problem, they suggested the jury instruction, and then they found out actually there was an error, he was innocent. And since then, the New Jersey Supreme Court has been very active in this area. So there's separate cases which are also really interesting, which we can talk about later if there's time, involving children. who you could imagine can be even more suggestible if police are making comments to them and encouraging them. So I've talked about this pattern already. The vast majority of these trials involve techniques that were suggestive. Not necessarily the kind of thing that you would think of as intentional misconduct, but the kinds of procedures that can predictably increase the confidence of an eyewitness. And second, the confidence of these eyewitnesses increased over time. In 57% of the cases, these witnesses either weren't certain, they couldn't make an identification at all, they identified other people, and yet by the time of trial, they were confident that they had the right one. And this is sort of a summary of all of that. So back to our lineup. So there's one other oddity in this case, which makes this image just totally amazing. So when the DNA testing was done years later, it matched the guy on the right. So I don't want to, you know, I didn't mean to forget about the only man there with a round face who's well built. Now, what was he doing there? It was just a complete happenstance. Not total happenstance, right? He actually was a rapist, and he was in prison for yet another crime, and happened to be there and picked as a filler. Not a very good filler, right? He kind of stands out. And now we can see why he looks uniquely unhappy to be there, maybe more so than even some of the others, because he was the actual culprit. But he just happened to be in prison, and he was put in the lineup. And so that makes this image totally incredible, right? Because the procedures that the police used, which no judge would think of as unduly suggestive or beyond the pale, right? Repeating just one person between the photo array and the lineup, telling the eyewitness we caught someone, those seemingly mild but suggestive procedures were enough to cause this eyewitness to look straight ahead and pick an innocent man and ignore the actual perpetrator who was right there staring her in the face. You know, all she had to do was look two people over to see the person who actually did it. And again, you know, maybe her eyesight wasn't great without her glasses, maybe it was dark, but that doesn't explain how you pick someone who looks very different than your description, particularly where the actual perpetrator is right there. And there are other cases like this, not many, but in the cases that I study, there's the Marvin Anderson case, a well-known case in Virginia, where the victim similarly saw the actual perpetrator, who by coincidence was in one of the photo arrays and didn't pick him out. But that's how powerful the effect of suggestion can be, even where it's not the kind of suggestion that might normally cause a court to be concerned, where police are doing something egregious, like saying, you know, look in the middle, look at the guy in the middle. We don't know, we have no evidence that they did anything like that here. And so there's John Jerome White standing there thinking he has nothing to fear, and he shouldn't. And there's the actual perpetrator looking a little terrified. He is ultimately convicted 22 years later, you know, when the DNA frees John Jerome White and implicates the man on the right. So I think cases like this really call into question a lot of the discussion before the Supreme Court yesterday. Now, the Perry case before the Supreme Court involves a somewhat technical issue. And the focus there is on the fact that the police didn't intend to do a suggestive lineup. So in this New Hampshire case, there's a report of a robbery. Someone is breaking into a car in the parking lot and taking the stereo. And the police show up at the scene, and there's a guy there kind of moving some of these equipment in the parking lot. He says he was just trying to get it out of the way so that no one would damage it. They tell him to stand there next to a police officer. And a second officer goes up into the apartment building to talk to one of the witnesses who made the call, and walk up the stairs. They go to her apartment, and she looks out the window and says, "That's the guy." Now, Perry was the only black man in the parking lot, and the report was of a tall black man, and he's standing next to a police officer. But the police say is, we didn't try to do a show-up meaning a one-on-one, is this the guy type identification. She looked out of the window on her own and identified him, but it wasn't our fault. There's no state action here, and so due process shouldn't apply because we didn't orchestrate this. If they had orchestrated it, there would be a question about whether a show-up was appropriate under those circumstances. And the police actually later did do a lineup in that case, and the eyewitness, who couldn't really describe much about the attacker, couldn't make an identification, actually. She could not identify Perry from the photo array. And at trial, she wasn't asked to identify him, maybe because neither side wanted to hear that testimony. But at trial, the trial court agreed that, look, the police didn't do anything intentional here, therefore there was no state action. We don't even do the due process analysis. And the New Hampshire Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court accepted cert. And now, putting to one side whether there are examples where there really wouldn't be state action. Say the eyewitness is walking down the street 2 weeks later and sees someone and says, that's the culprit, and then calls the police. That might raise a different question. If you think that state action is a requirement here, and that's a separate question too. But here the police did ask Perry to stand next to a police officer at the crime scene, and they go up to talk to the eyewitness. Identifications shouldn't occur at a crime scene location like that, right? If you're going to do a show-up, you want to do it at a neutral location. And what studies have shown is that mere association with the police, being held by the police like that, has a powerful suggestive effect. Now, if the police hadn't been there and the eyewitness saw Perry under different circumstances, would you then say the police didn't do anything to increase the likelihood that this identification would occur? Maybe you would. But I think it would be really disturbing if the court sort of carved out a whole category of show-ups, which are more suggestive than any other type of identification, and said, oh, no, due process doesn't regulate those. Because again, what we see from the cases I looked at is that it doesn't take intentional misconduct by police to corrupt someone's memory and cause a wrongful identification. Even unintentional and well-intentioned conduct by police officers, if it's suggestive, can cause a misidentification. Who knows what the Supreme Court will decide. What's not before the court is whether the entire framework, the Manson test, with those so-called reliability factors, should be totally revamped. That's what the New Jersey Supreme Court did. The New Jersey Supreme Court said most of those factors don't correspond with reliability at all. Right? Courts should look at, was this a cross-race identification? They should look at whether the eyewitness was focusing on a weapon. Right? There are other factors which we know really are important, and those aren't part of the analysis. New Jersey Supreme Court said, we should be conducting reliability hearings in every case. And when we look at suggestion, we shouldn't just be looking at did police do something intentional, but we should look at the procedures used. Now, New Jersey does something already, which most states don't. So not only do they have now this comprehensive framework where you do reliability hearings in every case, you look at the right factors informed by social science, and then you also have careful jury instructions. If the eyewitness does take the stand, you instruct the jury about all of these factors so that they understand how eyewitness memory works. They understand that confidence really shouldn't be have much weight placed on it. New Jersey already does double-blind lineups, and that's the crucial reform in this area. If you have someone administering the lineup that doesn't even know which person is the suspect, then that officer can't give unconscious cues. And what comes out of the social science research is that it may be unconscious cues that play an enormous role. That even just having an administrator there who knows which one is the suspect, even if the administrator is trying not to give any cues and doesn't remember giving any cues, it has a powerful effect on eyewitnesses. In Virginia, we're moving in that direction. In Virginia, like in other states, small departments complained and said, well, what if we don't have an extra officer to spare? But there's a simple technique that is offered by statute in North Carolina and Ohio as an option, where you just put the pictures in folders and shuffle them, and the eyewitness can open each folder up and see what picture's inside with the officer not being able to see what they're looking at. And so all you need is a stack of manila folders to make a lineup blind. So it's very easy. Again, though, there have been decades of this research. Police departments still haven't changed in most states. And there are a handful of states that have passed statutes requiring that these best practices be used, like blind lineups, like making sure you instruct the eyewitness that the attacker might or might not be here, like showing the pictures one at a time so you don't comparison shop and just pick out the person who looks most like the culprit. So you document, you know, the eyewitness' certainty. That's not hard to do, since their certainty the first time they make an identification is what's really probative. But before we end, let's talk about the Troy Davis case, because that's the eyewitness case that's maybe been in the news more than any other. And of course, he was executed. The federal district court that finally looked at the evidence of innocence on habeas, and we have with us, and maybe he'll tell us more about the case, a lawyer that worked on those habeas challenges, agreed that this case centered on eyewitness testimony. Post-conviction, Troy Davis's lawyers presented evidence that all but two of these eyewitnesses who put him at the scene of the shooting in a Burger King parking lot in Georgia, in Savannah, had recanted after trial. And that's been a lot of the focus. That was what the district court focused on and basically concluded, well, we don't credit all these recantations. We believe what they said at trial. You know, how do you know what to believe, the person now or then? You know, there's no DNA in the case. There's very little physical evidence of any kind, like you'd expect in a shooting where someone, where a shooting occurs and then the shooter leaves the scene without leaving much. What I focused on when I had a chance to look at some of the trial materials was, well, how did, not why did they recant, but how did these eyewitnesses come to identify Troy Davis in the first instance? And what I saw really bothered me, really kind of horrified me. So first of all, police had a picture of Troy Davis, you know, within a day of this shooting, right away. And they immediately put his picture in wanted posters and circulated them everywhere. They were running on the media. But the strange thing was they also had identified these eyewitnesses at the scene where this off-duty police officer was shot, intervening in this sort of fight in the Burger King parking lot. And why didn't they show that picture in the photo array that they prepared immediately to the eyewitnesses? Why do they wait 5 to 10 days to show these eyewitnesses the photo array? Right, lineups have to be done right away. We know from research that memory fades, you know, within hours. And yet they waited. During that time, single photos of just Troy Davis, the same one that was in the photo array, blanketed the neighborhood, was run on TV, all sorts of media were running this picture. But what was really amazing was that four of the key eyewitnesses, including someone who the Troy Davis team says really was the shooter, were brought back to the crime scene as part of this sort of staged reenactment. And that's something far more suggestive than anything I saw in the cases I looked at, except maybe a handful where police really did unusual things. And that involved, you know, not just asking them, you know, where did Troy Davis stand, and the suggestion involved in that, but also an effort to have them all work out together what happened and who was standing there. So it's sort of a getting stories straight sort of exercise. And they did that before those witnesses looked at the photo arrays. There is no explanation based on sound police practices for doing something like that. And even apart from that, eyewitnesses later described pressure to make an identification. There's this remarkable other eyewitness who is never shown the photo array because he says, look, I didn't see anything. I can't make an identification. I didn't see enough. And then somehow he surfaces close to the time of trial and says, oh, yeah, I'll come into court and identify him. And he does. So there's so many things that are disturbing about all of that. And of course, it's not a case where DNA testing can tell you anything about whether a mistake was made. And so, you know, Troy Davis is executed, and we're left with these lingering doubts about whether these eyewitnesses are to be credited or not. And amazingly, right, Troy Davis's case is a Georgia case. John Jerome White's case is a Georgia case. And there are a number of other DNA cases like John Jerome White's case, all Georgia cases. Has Georgia done anything to make sure that blind lineups or any of these other best practices are adopted around the state? You know, they passed a statute, maybe it was even in the form of a guideline, a state guideline, a few years ago saying police departments should have written policies on the subject of eyewitness identifications, which, like in Virginia, many just simply had nothing at all, no procedures at all, but nothing more than that. And so it's another one of these states where there have been high-profile cases where we'll never know the truth, high-profile cases where we do know the truth and we know that a mistake was made, and still you haven't seen any particular, you know, strong reaction from law enforcement, who you'd think has the strongest interest in getting these eyewitness identifications right. And at the same time, you have the Supreme Court unlikely to really do anything that's going to make an important change in the area. And so it's left to states like New Jersey to provide a model, and then there's the question of, will other states take this problem seriously like New Jersey did? Maybe not.